on Public Safety Policy and Finance, March 2, 2005. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland. Cornish. Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson. Messlow.
Here.
Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Tamar.
Here.
Soderstrom.
Here. Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, so we'll review the minutes from the previous meeting. March 1, 2005, they are in the packet. Is there a motion? Representative Johnson moves approval. Are there any questions or discussion on the motion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. All right, we're going to return to House File 1244, Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, I believe the DCA would like to provide some testimony and background on what is currently happening in the state regarding DNA collection, and I think that's where we're at, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sir, welcome again, and thanks for coming back. And would you sign in and proceed?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name is Frank Dolish. I'm the laboratory director at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Laboratory. I started yesterday with a overview of our DNA program, and so I'm going to slip by some of these real quick that we talked about yesterday. Again, our program started back in 1989 with sex offenders, was expanded to predatory arrestee offenses in 2000, and to expanded to include all felons in 2002. We currently have about 31,000 offender profiles in CODIS, which stands for Combined DNA Index System. We have, as I mentioned yesterday, a backlog of about 19,700 samples. As when the all felony bill passed, we were funded only to collect those samples and not to analyze them. And we have, by necessity, waited for federal grants to become available. We have done and are doing some of those backlog samples through these NIJ grants, and they're being sent out to two private laboratories for the actual analysis. The data sent back to us, we have to review that, and then that's loaded into the database system. We have a grant to complete all but about 6,000 to 7,000 samples that have come in since July of last year. All states participate in the National DNA Index System, and at this point in time, the samples that we send to the federal database are only convicted felon adults. Up until last year, when Congress passed the Justice for All Act, we were limited to sending adults to that system. Under the Justice for All Act, Congress has authorized the inclusion of convicted juveniles as well. So when that is finally set in place by the FBI, we will be able to send samples to the federal database as well. The federal database, as of December of 2004, has over 2 million profiles. The forensic profiles are those cases where they have evidence that they're trying to match to the database, and those samples stay in there to be searched periodically against new samples that are coming in. And the some Minnesota statistical information at this point in time, we have about 23, a little over 23, almost 24,000 sample offender profiles in the system. We have, these are forensic samples, these are cases where we don't have suspects that are sitting there again, about 1,600 samples. There are three CODIS labs that can search that database in Minnesota. We have our laboratory in St. Paul that's a certified CODIS lab. Our laboratory in Bemidji is a participant in this program. And the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office has a DNA laboratory, and they search against that database. Now, St. Paul is the only facility that does offender samples and puts them into the database. So their connection is to be able to search those samples against active cases. Since the program has been online in Minnesota, we've had 218 cases that have been aided. And I want to, this next slide, I think, points out the relevance of being able to do the felony convictions. And you can see that between 1991 and 2002, when the all-felony bill went into place, that the number of hits that we had in any particular year was anything from 1 to 11 in 2001. And that probably, even that increase, probably was reflective of the additional samples that we got for the predatory offenders when that change was made. But last year alone, this is for 1994, we had almost 100 cases that were linked and solved because we have this database in place. For every 1,000 samples that we've been uploading to that database, we have solved between 7 and 10 cases. Just to show that real live cases, that this system is working. This was the assault, and I've taken these out of the paper, so this is obviously public information that happened in Concordia. And this is a case of a juvenile that was in the system, and he was linked to two separate rapes that happened where, in both cases, they didn't have any idea who the suspect in the case was. And from DNA taken from the victims, we were able to link it to this particular individual. A couple of other cases, one in Ramsey County, and you have that handout, and then a case where an individual was linked to three separate assaults. And it's not unusual to actually be able to solve multiple cases when this happens. Just in summary, all 50 states are participating in CODIS now. They all, at the minimum, will collect sex offenders and add them to the federal database. 50 states require all 50 states then require convicted sex offenders. 38 states require DNA from convicted felons at this point in time, and I think there's legislation to expand that in a number of states. And as was indicated earlier, at least 4 states require DNA from arrested felons. I should point out that a couple of those don't take effect for a while. California, for example, under theirs, I don't think the arrestees portion of their statute takes effect until 2009. They're starting out in the coming year with the convicted felons. And I think that Texas, which is one of the other states, was contingent on them finding funding for them to be able to run those samples. And so I don't know whether they're actually collecting them and running them at this point in time, but I can check into that if anybody's interested. There were several issues that members brought up yesterday that I thought that maybe rather than waiting for questions, I'd try to address so that maybe we can keep this on track.
Mr. Dolish, before you do that, I just want to interrupt. We always welcome groups of students and others that come to visit the Capitol as well as this committee, and we do have a group with us today, and they are, we'd like to welcome you, ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. Welcome. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, one of the questions that has been raised is the issue of juveniles, and just for informational purposes, juveniles have been included in the current law since its inception in 1989. And as I indicated, up until the law changed last year at the federal level, we were not able to upload those juvenile samples into the federal database. But under the Justice for All Act in 1994, that will authorize us to do that. And but that has not started yet. There are some technical things that we have to work out with the FBI. The other question that it was posed to me was what authority do we have to keep those juvenile samples, and under, let me find my note. Under current law, at least our reading of it, and it's one of the sections that's being struck under this bill, it's 299C.11 subdivision D and E. It talks about DNA samples not being taken out of the system, and as a matter of fact, the current, I don't know if you want to call it policy or practice, is that the only samples that we've taken out of the database system have been those samples that were incorrectly taken. In other words, maybe they were submitted because they were convicted of something other than a felony, or a case where the court had ordered that the sample be removed. In terms, somebody had asked about samples that we get for comparison, what I'll call forensic cases, let's say we have a case where there's an assault and we get samples from the case from the victim or from the scene. Oftentimes, law enforcement will provide samples from suspects either through them volunteering to give it or through a court order. And to let you know, those samples are not included in the DNA database. They are part of that case and belong to that case, and that's part of a criminal investigation. Those samples are not included in the database. If that person is convicted, the jurisdiction would have to take a DNA sample at that time. We would run that sample, and that would be included in the database. So we are not including samples that are provided as part of investigations into our database. It's an issue that's come up and has been alluded to, and that has to do with the use of these DNA samples for anything other than identification. And there have been some implications that because we have these samples that we're going to be able to look at somebody's DNA to tell whether or not they have, I think the words were blue eyes, or whether they have a propensity or maybe would have a genetic disorder or something like that. The area of the DNA that we're looking at for identification is a portion of the DNA, at least at this point in time in science, they refer to as spacer or junk DNA. It does not code for any proteins, and the reason we find this very useful area is because of the variability of this of the areas that we're looking at. Now, we do, however, save those samples, and I feel that we have a legitimate reason to continue to save those samples after we run them for two reasons, and one of them we've experienced already. When we started the database in 1989, we were using a technology called RFLP. We were looking at portions of the DNA that are called restriction fragment length polymorphisms. It was a very labor-intensive process. It took us months to process samples. In probably about 10 years ago, new DNA technology came along that's based on something called short tandem repeat. And had we not had those samples, any samples that we would have received before the new technology went online would be useless in the database. It's not like a computer thing where you can convert these samples to the new technology. We are actually, with this new technology, looking at different areas of the DNA than we did when the program started. The second issue, reason why we like to have the samples, is it's a quality assurance thing and a protection, I think, a protection for the individual. Because when we have a hit, we go back to that sample, we rerun it to make sure that we didn't mix up samples in processing them before we would tell the law enforcement that we believe this is the individual. Even then, we don't depend on the database for the final criminal charge. We ask the law enforcement agency to go out and get a new sample from that individual. They submit that, and we run DNA on that. So we try to put a number of checks and balances on this database and how we use it. Current law does say that this database and these samples are only available for law enforcement purposes. Somebody asked, how does this database exonerate subjects? If we get a case where the department has a suspect in mind, oftentimes we will search that against the database. If we find out that it matches somebody else, they're not going to probably spend any more time on that suspect. They now have a new suspect that they have to deal with. So it's a little twist of this, but that is how the database itself can exonerate people. DNA in and of itself in our criminal cases obviously does that a lot. In fact, with our DNA samples from criminal cases, we probably eliminate suspects as many as in 20-25% of the cases that come in, so that this is a technology that helps exonerate people as well as implicate them. With that, I guess I can take questions.
Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, sir. It's true, isn't it, that the DNA information that you all maintain is kept on a computer and can be transferred within your department from one computer to another. Is that right?
Mr. Dawes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, it is kept on a computer. If you were to go and look at that profile, unless you're a geneticist, the information that's there is not going to be anything to you. It's at each loci that we're doing an analysis, we get data back, and so what's stored in the computer are a series of numbers that represent the types at these various loci. But yes, it is kept on a computer. This is a secure network. It's only in the laboratory. This is not something that is part of the CJIS network, the Criminal Justice Information System stuff, and the criminal history record. This CODIS database is maintained as a separate database within our laboratory.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
And you can, and as I asked before, you can certainly transfer this database from one workstation to another. I guess my question is this. If this information is kept on a database, you can share it with other people who are in your department, what if a mistake happens? What if somebody transfers it outside to the wrong database, or what if somebody hacks into it and has some geneticists on staff or on payroll? Then is it possible that this genetic information could fall into the wrong hands? And because yesterday I passed out a newspaper article, which everybody got, wherein ChoicePoint accidentally sent 10,000 different individuals' private information out into the public sphere. So I guess my question is, I mean, people can hire a geneticist. I mean, you know, your staff is not the only geneticist in the country, and maybe not all geneticists are as honorable as the people on your staff. Is it possible that people can either hack in or mistakenly transfer data, and because we've seen mistakes like that made in the past, what are the assurances that that can never happen?
Mr. Dolly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison. In terms of, and maybe I misspoke, we have limited access to that database. They are from computers and individuals that have passed FBI backgrounds. We have to clear them with the FBI before they can have access to that database. So we aren't transferring data from computer to computer. You're using a computer as a terminal to access the database on the server. In terms of security, that system is as secure as anybody can make any computer system in the country, and a lot of this is also controlled by FBI and FBI requirements for anybody that participates in the CODIS database system, because besides our own database, we are also linked to the national database, so there are a number of security protocol, firewalls, again, as safe as you can make any computer anywhere. We have those systems in place.
But one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Well, just quick comment. I did pass out this article, which says, in part, recently Atlanta-based ChoicePoint, Inc. confirmed the release of personal information of more than 100,000 customers. So, I mean, mistakes happen, and I'm not asking you to comment on that. I'm just showing you that mistakes have happened, and if you got human beings, mistakes happen. My question is, my next question is actually for the author of the bill, Representative Paulson. Representative Paulson, the testifier carefully explained that while the total universe of information to be gleaned from a DNA sample is in the possession of the government, of people who have their samples collected, they only use a little bit of that, just identifying information. Is there anything in your bill that would restrict the government to only using identifying information and not other information such as, you know, genetic proclivity to illness or disease, which an insurance company probably would like to have, or other sort of information that other people in the commercial realm might find desirable, or even some, you know, is there any way to restrict, is there anything in the bill that says only identifying information is what is available to be used?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I believe the language in the bill, and I ask counsel to comment, but I think it's directly, strictly limited to law enforcement purposes only, and I think that's the identification model right now, unless counsel has additional comment.
Let's get a confirmation from Mr. Beeble on that. Is that answer correct?
Mr. Chair and members,
yes.
Representative Ellison, do you have anything further?
Mr. Chair, does it say only identification information or law enforcement purpose? I believe could be broadly interpreted. Can we? Is it in the bill to say only identifying information as opposed to any law enforcement purpose?
Mr. Beeble?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ellison, it doesn't say identification purposes only. It says law enforcement purposes, which is what Representative Paulson said.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, Representative Ellison has had some questions concerning the security of the database. Could you compare the security of the database for me as to, for instance, the security of the evidence that's contained in a property room? I mean, can you sit here and absolutely guarantee us that nobody is ever going to break into a property room and steal the actual DNA samples or drugs or whatever else that might be in the property room?
Mr. Dolley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do everything that's physically and technically possible to protect both evidence that we deal with and any database information, including our case records, which are confidential law enforcement information as well. So we do everything we can that's technically feasible and possible to protect both evidence and these databases so that only those that are authorized to have access to it have access to it. For example, the offender database is not available to all of my lab staff. It's only available to those individuals that have FBI clearance and have a legitimate use to be able to access that database.
Any additional questions? If not, Mr. Dolish, wait a minute. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with how we balance the needs of public safety to against the kind of the rights of private people wanting to have some assurances that we're not living in a Big Brother state. And all the illustrations that you gave about data that you were transferring to the federal government and those kind of things in other states, it seems like it's all based on convicted felons. And I guess that's what concerns me a little bit about this bill is that it doesn't say that. It says if we're arrested for, it doesn't require a search warrant. It doesn't require the courts to even validate that there's good probable cause. It could be the opinion of a police officer that there's probable cause. So I'm going to arrest them and I'm going to require this DNA test. If in fact that turns out to be a dead lead, that information is just in the database forever. Or if it's not in the database, if it's taken out of the database, the material is still there. And it seems like if there's a right to be able to collect the data, if you suspect somebody's guilty, if they're proven not guilty, you have a right of the person that you collected it from to take it back if they want it. And I think that's where I'm struggling with this whole bill. You want to comment to that?
I'll comment, Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland. I think we had some discussion about that yesterday, and there are some provisions in the bill. So if an arrestee is found not guilty, does not have a felony conviction within the preceding years, as Mr. Backstrom had pointed out as well, they can petition the court to have the information expunged. And I think we had a good discussion about that yesterday. I think there are some things to potentially work on. But, you know, make no mistake and don't be confused. There's no doubt that this, with this technology, literally hundreds of lives are being saved. Hundreds of lives will be saved. Victims will be protected. There's no doubt about that. I mean, even with in Virginia, for instance, with the arrestee of the felony provisions that they have on the violent felons, they have 300 to 400 hits per year, cold hits per year. But I understand your concern, Mr. Eastland. Other members have talked to me about that, and I think that we're going to have a good discussion. I think the bill, the intent of the committee, is to send it to civil law and work on some of these issues and bring it back before the committee.
Representative Paulson and Representative Eastland and members, that is the motion that I'll amend, that the bill be recommended to pass, be re-referred to civil law, and that it be brought back here. Civil law needs to look at the expungement issues and data practices issues specifically. And then we can take back up the criminal procedural issues and the other issues that we've been raising. And then Mr. Neumeister also has raised. Representative Tamar, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is the time to do it or when the bill comes back, but I would like the author to consider an amendment that I would like to make, which would be to delete Section 4 of the bill.
Representative Tamar.
Wait a second. I'll wait to Representative Paulson. And talk with him. I just want to explain my motivation for doing this and ask him to consider this as it moves through the process.
I'd like you to do that right now, and then you can have a formal formal amendment prepared later. But as far as any discourse back and forth, I think we will save that.
Okay. Representative Paulson, I certainly understand your intent, and I think we're all sort of split on this issue about whether DNA is the 21st century fingerprint. And I think in some respects, in Section 3, I not only understand your intent, but perhaps support your intent, although that may need a little bit of work. But I understand in terms of persons arrested for murder, manslaughter, assault, robbery, kidnapping, false imprisonment, criminal sexual conduct, indecent exposure, burglary. I think that these are the kinds of crimes that obviously the public is most concerned of relative to public safety. I think where it becomes more problematic is in Section 4, when in 2010 you then extend that to all individuals arrested but not charged or convicted with any felony, which could mean, I mean, there's a multiple listings of felonies, both violent and nonviolent. So, you know, in your attempt to capture perhaps the most dangerous convicts or offenders, the net is so large that you're capturing thousands of individuals who perhaps didn't really commit the crime, and then forcing thousands of people to go through expungement proceedings that Representative Meslow said that wasn't that expensive. I'd like to hear more about that, but certainly time-consuming, and there's all kinds of issues related to that about how you inform the defendant that, you know, your DNA was taken, you have the right to take it back. It's very problematic, and it really is a civil liberties issue, I think, that. So I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you'd like me to offer the amendment now, or if Representative Paulson wants to think about it as it goes to civil law and comes back here, and we'll have more discussion on it, and I'd offer it then, or maybe he would consider removing Section 4 himself.
That's the gist of your, will be the gist of your amendment, is to delete Section 4.
That's correct.
Okay, that's clearly adequate information for purposes of now, and when the bill is back, then we will take up your amendment at that time. And having said that, Mr. Neumeister, right. I'd like to now go to you. Just a minute until you're recognized.
All right.
You do have some written material here, and I want you to point out the criminal procedural issues. I don't want any long-winded, long discussion of it, because this will come back, and you'll have an additional time to more fully describe this. But please, at this time, point out what you would like us to consider when this bill returns. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. Basically, the memo is laid out. I took up on your invite to do a memo. As I continue to research, I am doing different things. I've highlighted very specific areas. The whole issue of law enforcement purpose already came up. The arrestee, the expungement issue. And the other thing I just basically wanted to finish up on my testimony yesterday was the issue of CODIS. And one of the things I have some concerns about that is whether the policy should be, should we be sending juvenile and arrest information to the FBI? And second one, in Justice for All, I have not read the final bill, but I read it as Hatch and Leahy were doing it. They did have an automatic expungement provision in there, and I don't know where that sits now as it passed. And the final thing is Frank and I go back. I first met him in 1989 when Kelly and Spear first introduced this stuff. As much as I know, and this is important for definition, there are things that, and it's basically my last summary statement on the third page. There's the profile that's on the computer, and then the sample is in some freezer refrigerator somewhere, whether it be at the BCA or on the local level. And Frank can verify that. That has always been my impression. There's the sample itself, and in the profile, the loci, that's of the 13 points. And there are two different things of items. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my points, and as folks know, I'm around here all the time, and any questions or whatever, I can certainly help.
That's fair. Thank you. We do have your written proposal. At this time, Representative Ellison, do you have an additional question? I'd like to bring this up for moving on.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to inform the committee that I did some informal research last night. And I dug through my files in my office for the number of expungements that I did since 2001. 2001, I did 7. 2002, I did 6. 2003, I did 3. And then last year, I did 4. And I can assure you that they are long, cumbersome, difficult things to do. I mean, I have done them. I'm not speaking theoretically. And you have to serve about 12 different agencies. You have to research the person's criminal record. If you have more than one conviction in one county, you've got to go all over the place to do that. The records are often not clear. And I just want to disabuse anyone of the idea that this is a simple procedure. It is not. It is a very difficult procedure. And as a matter of fact, Judge Lejeune Lang has been conducting seminars for the public on how to do these expungements. Yeah, we pass out booklets, but people routinely don't know how to get through these things. You probably need a significant amount of education and even time to do an expungement yourself. Although people do them, they are hard and often need a lawyer to do them. And I can tell you that the amount of time that this call requires me to put in, this can be an expensive proposition for your average citizen. So I just want to say that, you know, one person's experience is as good as another's, and I don't want to discount anybody else's experience. But there is, but based on my experience, an expungement is a very difficult proposition. And in fact, there are problems with the expungement bill as it already exists, which I hope to take up one day. So I just want to put that on the record to at least give two sides of the story.
Representative Meslow, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps when the bill comes back, it would be appropriate to bring the chief judge from Ramsey County or somebody else in to testify, because in Ramsey County, it's a fill-in-the-blank form. And it does need to get mailed to half a dozen places, but it says where it is that everything needs to get mailed. The chief judge has a regular calendar. Sometimes an appearance is necessary. Sometimes an appearance is not necessary. I can just tell you that I've been through that process on both ends. Easily a couple dozen times, and the process has continued to get easier and easier in Ramsey County to where it's become a very routine kind of matter, running very smoothly.
I think it would be appropriate to have additional information on the process of the procedure of expungement. But at this time, motion is back before us. Your bill, Representative Paulson, assuming the motion moves, it will be to move the bill to civil law so they can take a look at the expungement issues and the data practices issues, and then we will come back here and discuss everything for a vote next time that we've been discussing today and any additional amendments that may swim by and that we can look at. So the chair renews his, renews his motion that House File 1244 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to civil law, as stated, and with a request to that committee that we that it be re-referred here. Any further discussion on that amendment? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. And thank you, Representative Paulson. We're going to go right into the amendments that were presented and laid over last time relative to the methamphetamine bill. Representative Johnson, the chief author of that bill, was moved out of here, was moved along at that time. So now we will turn our attention to discussion of some amendments by Representative Soderstrom and Representative Hamar. So we'll take you in the order as listed. Representative Soderstrom, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am State Representative Judy Soderstrom, and I represent District 8B, which includes Pine County, Canadian County, and for your information, we have a lot of meth labs and meth problems in my two counties, actually part of Isanti County, too.
Go ahead.
Should I just go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead. Let's go through the chair. We'll speak one at a time, but we all know what's before us, so just take up your amendments and discuss them as casually as you choose. If you have expert witnesses or someone to testify, call them at that time, and then we'll interrupt if you want to get the chair's attention, any member, and ask you questions as we go along. Bear in mind, we have 55 minutes, and we are not acting on any of these amendments today. We are reviewing them for action at a later time. So keep that in mind as well. Representative Soderstrom, you have the floor. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The first amendment that I had was for jail education. And I just feel that in our local jails, this is where we are seeing all of the offenders are coming in, and they're in our jails for a meth offense. And so,
for purposes of the record, that let's just at least identify the specific amendment. That'd be A1 amendment.
Okay, right? This is the A1 amendment.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and the amendment is very simple. It just says the Commissioner of Health should develop materials for use by sheriffs in educating county jail inmates on the health hazards of methamphetamine and its use and manufacture. And my sheriff did call me this morning. They're, of course, don't like to have to do something more, but I would think that this would be just one little piece of the puzzle that would help to perhaps stop one or two people and from using, going on to use meth. And I talked to Deb Durkin this week, who works with our meth at the Department of Health, and there are a number of excellent videos and materials, and I do believe that when an inmate comes before the judge and the judge asks him if he understands the dangers of methamphetamine, if he can tell the judge that he has seen a video a number of times and has received some material about methamphetamine, that certainly would be good for him, and it might make him change his actions for the future. So that's just this the amendment. I won't say any more about that.
Okay. I think it would be fair, Representative Johnson, you're the author on the bill that these amendments are aimed at. It might be a good idea to get your initial reaction right away now, and then members can chime in or ask you as well. So, Representative Johnson, do you wish to be heard?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question on this would be, and there may be somebody here that can answer the question, do we have any evidence that this is an effective form of, I don't know if you want to call it treatment or not, but it would actually have an effect on a meth addict? Because I have not seen that.
No, we don't, but every place we go, it's education. And on Monday night of this week, I was in Graham, and Senator Mark Dayton was there, and Congressman Oberstar was there, and there were like over 400 people, and they talked much about the importance of educating the public and our high school students and so forth. So I guess I just feel that education would be important within the jail setting.
Representative Soderstrom, between now and when we take up your amendment for a vote, can you provide us, or I'm asking you if you would try to provide us with a sampling or a sample of the audiovisual recording that you are proposing, or written materials that may already be in existence, something that we can look at in considering your amendment. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification on process. Fiscal notes. I know that we've requested a fiscal note on the bill. I'm certain that many of these amendments will have some fiscal impact either in the positive or to the negative. At what point are we going to see any numbers or required numbers? Or I'm just curious.
Well, if Representative Hillstrom, it darn well better be between now and the end of March when we take this bill back up. We have a fiscal note requested for the bill itself, I think. And we had one, but it was for a previous version of the bill. Bottom line is I expect fiscal notes on the bill and all amendments to be in our hands well before we discuss, or at least by the time we discuss and vote on them next time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, have you discussed this amendment with the Department of Health? And did they have a positive reaction?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. I just have discussed it with Deb Durkin, who works for the Department of Health, and she just said they have many videos available and material available. So it would, it's no problem getting the material. And I will look at those and get them. I have to order them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Representative Adams, and then would the sheriff then order them from the Department of Health? Or would they be at lending library, or would they become possessions of the sheriff's
department? Representative
Soderstrom. Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, it would. I would presume that the county commissioners or the health, the people that work with the local health department would help to get those things, and perhaps I would think that this should be. Perhaps could be given when they have their AA meetings at the jail or their NA meetings and part of that program, because this is a drug. So when they can use that as part of their program when they come in once a week to the jail.
We have a witness at the table. Identify yourself. Can you add to this discussion?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Kino. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health Methamphetamine Program. And in regard to what information we currently have available, we do a lot of educational material. We have a lot of that available on our website. We have not produced an audiovisual tape ourselves, but can recommend ones that have been done by the state of Hawaii, and could provide contact information for the sheriffs to access that information on their own. But we do have some educational material that's already available, but if it's specific audiovisual material developed by the MDH, we don't have that capability or have that at this time.
Ms. Kino, you say that someone in Hawaii has produced an audiovisual.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They have produced two videos, and one was about the meth crisis at large. They are the state that has one of the biggest problems in the country, and the other one is addressing meth use by teens. And if I believe correctly, I think the videos cost about $15.
Are those videos, do you know if those videos or similar videos are used in Hawaii's correctional system or any state in the union? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, I cannot answer that question.
Can you find out?
I can try
to find out.
Well, I can do that.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question for Ms. Kino. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but do you have an opinion, or has the department suggested any opinion on this amendment as to whether this would be effective or efficient use of time or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that would be a question more appropriately answered by the Department of Human Services and their chemical treatment folks. We don't deal with that area. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Soderstrom, have you also talked to the associations that oversee your county or local jails about how this would be implemented, or if there's an issue with it or a concern at all? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, this morning I talked to my sheriff called me about this because he had been called by someone. But, you know, when I explained to him that this would be material that could just be used with their, when they come in and do their NA or their AA programming, it's not extra time, and people are there that can do that. I don't think it's going to be a hardship on our local jails or sheriffs. I just think it's important that these people know the dangers, and they most of the inmates in jail have children. I mean, I do a jail ministry. I talk to them all the time. They have children, and they have they need to know the dangers.
If there's no other questions, we're going to move on to your A4 amendment. Tell us about that, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is the A4 amendment.
Do you have any testifier besides yourself on this? Is there anybody that wanted to testify? Why don't you wait, sir? One person did ask, and I don't know if he's going to be friendly or not, but they're identified. So go ahead and tell us about the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will just say that I read about anhydrous ammonia, and that there is something somewhere out there, something pink that you can put into anhydrous ammonia, and so then it shows up on the offender's hands or around their face or something, so it's an indication maybe that they're using meth. But when I was researching this, then I became aware that New York is studying ferrocene. It's something that can be added to anhydrous ammonia and would make it so that they cannot make methamphetamine with it. And so I chose, instead of researching the other product, and this is just a study, so it, you know, I don't know what the cost would be.
Where?
So that's, I'm just bringing forward for a study.
Any questions of the author? Representative Eastman.
In the production of methamphetamine, if they don't have anhydrous ammonia, what would they use as a replacement? What else can they use for that ingredient in the processing of methamphetamine? Do we know?
Representative Soderstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastman, I don't know. I think that maybe Representative Johnson would know. It's Sudafed that they must have. And so I think they maybe can work with something else also. But it is one of the ingredients, definitely, that's used in Minnesota to manufacture.
Mr. Chair, I
think it's iodine.
I believe it's iodine, but Mr. O'Malley probably can give a more intelligent answer than I can.
Well, let's have him give an answer, and then
I can decide.
We'll decide. I'd also like to hear from you on this amendment as well. Sir, your name?
Tim O'Malley. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Just very briefly, there are two ways to make methamphetamine. One involves the anhydrous ammonia that Representative Soderstrom was just describing. Secondly is the process that uses red phosphorus. That's the materials that are found in matches. You need a very large quantity of that. It's easier to do it with the anhydrous ammonia, although it's dangerous, but it's a little easier. And generally, your yield is at a higher quantity level or a higher quality level. You'll get better methamphetamine from the anhydrous ammonia process. And as the representative mentioned, either way, you need pseudoephedrine.
Representative, excuse me, Johnson, did you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm open to this, although I know that there are some concerns from some of the agriculture folks that I've talked with, and I'd be curious to hear from the representative from the department.
Let's do that. Before you leave the table, Mr. O'Malley, you presented a presentation the other day, and that one slide that showed the map of Minnesota where you ticked off first one red dot identifying the location, and then a second one, and then a third one, and then many more describing the brutality that occurred at each one. That was very haunting. And I think that would be the kind of message, if the entire state saw, they might understand the gravity of this issue. Sir, you were coming up to the table.
Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Lemont, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm section manager in the Agronomy and Plant Protection Division. Under Minnesota Statutes 18C, the Commissioner of Agriculture and our department regulate and enforce the fertilizer laws, including anhydrous ammonia. And first off, I should tell you that I, representing the department, have been a participant with the multi-agency group of large group of people that have been working on the methamphetamine issue for about 4 or 5 years. So the concerns that I bring are highlighted by my personal and my professional knowledge of the methamphetamine issue. First off, I guess I should let you know that this is not a new idea, that as we sit here, the state of Iowa, Iowa State University, and several people there, as well as the state of New York, are also studying this issue. And they are far down the road, in fact. The state of Iowa, in regard to a third additive called calcium nitrate, has received, and I have a copy of it here, it was faxed to me yesterday, approval from the feds that this additive, calcium nitrate, is an effective ingredient to prohibit or to resist the use of this anhydrous ammonia for the production of methamphetamine. New York is looking at calcium nitrate, ferrocene, and Glotel, which is an additive that simply dyes the product, so you can see where it's being misused or stolen. The state of Iowa is currently engaged in studies funded by the U.S. Department of Transportation to see if the addition of the calcium nitrate additive will stress metals so as to create a hazard unto itself in the anhydrous ammonia tanks. So I don't want to belabor this, but I want to tell you that two large ongoing studies are going on right now. We are in touch with both states, and I'm sure it's going on elsewhere. To the extent that we can be a participant in a multi-agency study, we certainly can. I think efficient government would end up us using a lot of the information that's already been generated elsewhere. I do want to let you know, and I'm not attributing any sort of personal or department position on this, but the researchers in Iowa are right now estimating the cost at $1.08 per acre per corn acre. That in Iowa would have resulted in, if you'll bear with me, I think this is an important figure because the ag community may come and let you know this as well. In calendar year 2004, that would have resulted in an additional cost, adding the calcium nitrate to anhydrous ammonia that is used in corn, at $7.75 million. And that, I think, is viewed by the ag community as a fairly significant cost. I do not have figures, even though I asked as recently as this morning on the ferrocene or the Glotel.
Representative Johnson, any initial comment?
Mr. Chair, well, that was the concern that I had heard from some of the ag representatives, some of our rural representatives, and that would concern me, obviously, and I don't want another stop on this bill to agriculture, which I would be willing to bet they'd take it and delete this amendment if we put it in. But
we see their ethanol bill in the
screen. I imagine we could if you wanted to.
Go ahead.
So that's my concern.
Okay, any questions? If Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if we could have Mr. O'Malley come back down. I just
Mr. O'Malley, would you come back, please? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Malley, the other day when you were here testifying about meth, I got the distinct impression that Sudafed and its derivatives is absolutely essential in the production of meth. And now we're talking about adding some controls to ammonium, or essentially agricultural fertilizer. I'd like your opinion as to whether or not additional controls in terms of ammonia is going to be of any assistance if we, in fact, control the Sudafed and its derivatives.
Mr. O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, as I stated and you just repeated, the pseudoephedrine is the essential ingredient. If they cannot get pseudoephedrine, they will not make methamphetamine, whether it's the red phosphorus or the anhydrous ammonia method. Having said that, if they have if the access to anhydrous ammonia is restricted, certainly that would be helpful. But bear in mind that there's still that other alternative. There's still the red phosphorus alternative. And in the range of 25 to 30% of labs in Minnesota are red phosphorus. Most are anhydrous ammonia. But the recipe and the ability to do that is out there. I don't think that the overall effect would be it wouldn't be anywhere near as effective as getting rid of the pseudoephedrine access.
Very good. Representative, thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Representative Soderstrom, you have a third amendment. Can we get to that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
SB83, is it? Which one? I think it's the A3 one, is that correct?
Correct. The A3 amendment.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just would like to give you a little background. I think all of you know that I do a jail, faith-based jail ministry in Connecticut County Jail and occasionally in the Pine County Jail. So when I became a member of this committee 2 years ago, I realized that this committee is very much tough on crime. I felt that they really wanted to lock everybody up, throw away the key, and put them on bread and water. I'm being exaggerating, but that I do feel that we need to look at even for public safety. We need to think about treatment and education follow up with those who are particularly on meth and other drugs. And our numbers are increasing as far in our prison population is increasing. And so I think that we need to start looking at treatment. And in our high school in Mora, they're saying that there are 25 to 30% of our young people are on methamphetamine or using methamphetamine. And so it's getting to be that everyone knows someone on meth. And I mentioned before that on Monday night we had a meth meeting at the Graham High School, and there were perhaps 500 people there. We heard a lot of stories even from the audience of people that had relatives and that they themselves had been on meth and talked about how hard it was on the family and the exposure of children and so forth. So I know that this problem is growing very rapidly. I do think that we need to start thinking about treatment, and my bill would divert people to a long-term treatment center instead of putting them into prison. A lot of our meth people are really young people, and I don't think that they should be put into the prison situation with hardened criminals. And they are not, we don't separate them in prison, so that we have a lot of these young 18, 19-year-olds that are being put into our prison system. And the other problem is that when you send somebody to prison, you have made them a felon. And when they get out, they have a hard time finding a place to live. They have a hard time getting a job. They have a hard time applying for a college loan. And there's a lot of things that happen once you become a felon. And so I'd like our courts to start looking at long-term treatment instead. And I did just talk to Gary, and he had some, was going to just give you a few figures just to refresh you about the growth of prisons in Minnesota. I think that one statistic was that we're second now in the nation, and if you could just go ahead and share those figures with the committee.
Mr. Carter?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, to that point, I think Minnesota has a relatively low incarceration rate compared to other states. In fact, the latest statistics from the Bureau of Justice say that we're 49th. However, the justice statistics also show that the correction population in Minnesota is increasing at a faster rate than the nation. The latest numbers from 2002 to 2003 showed an average increase nationwide at 1.4%. Minnesota was second with a 10.3% increase. During that same time period, 11 states had actual decreases in their prison population. In 2002, the average increase, or from 2001 to 2002, the average increase nationwide was 1.2%. Minnesota had a 7.9% increase. They were tied at third. If we go back another year, the average was 1.1%. Minnesota had a 5.9% increase.
Thank you. And so with that, then also part of my amendment would say that we need to do an RFP to either private or state could bid on a long-term treatment program. And I've talked to only, there are a number of private companies that do long-term treatment centers throughout the United States. And probably the largest, the company that does the largest is called Cornell, and they do very intensive treatment there and have vocational training and counseling, medical treatment there, GED classes, and so forth. So they have a lot of programs that they offer. And just to talk about the success and the cost, I just heard some testimony in Health and Human Services last week that perhaps the average cost of treatment, we usually send people to 28-day programs, and the average, it averages like $11,000 for that 28 days. And I just clipped from the newspaper that Hazleton, for instance, where we send a number of people go from our local jail to Hazleton for treatment, is $22,000 for that 28-day program. And Cornell indicated to me that they could do a treatment program for the same cost that we put somebody in prison for a year. So there would be a savings if we're giving people 5 and 6 year prison terms, and if we can get them through a 1 year treatment program, it would be a savings of those 3 or 4 years in prison. And I did ask, Minnesota Teen Challenge has a very successful program, and one of the reasons their program is so successful is long-term, it's 13 months. And so I've asked, there's three of their students and then the director of the women's program that's here, and they're just going to share a few minutes, and you can ask them some questions if you would like.
That'd be fine. While they're coming up there, Representative Soderstrom, you represented to us that Cornell, I think you indicated a privateer, would house in their treatment facility at the same cost that it cost Minnesota to house a prisoner. What is that dollar amount?
Well, I just quoted to them that which is like $77, is it, a day? Or it's the $30,000 a year. But they said that they could do that without any problem, a year program. And of course, the larger they are, I mean, if they're, my is calling for an RFP for 750 beds or and so forth. So they, it would be a secure facility, but it would be more like a minimum prison.
Okay, just after the meeting, tell our committee administrator who it was you've talked to so we can get those dollar amounts and check on that. Ladies and gentlemen, we want to hear from you. We also have another representative who has amendments that we want to get to. So I'd like you to be 2 or 3 minutes each. If you could keep it real brief, say your name and sit up to the microphone when you talk.
Hello, my name is Sarah Lakeband. I'm the Assistant Dean of Women at Minnesota Teen Challenge. And we are a 13-month program. It is long-term, faith-based, and it has a couple of different levels that the students go through. There are 4 different levels, and right now we have a little over 300 students in our program. We call them students because they are studying, and they're studying all throughout the day to go through classes and learning about their, you know, chemical dependency issues, but then also going through character development, finances, to help them to go through a program where they can learn and change and then actually be productive out in the community when they graduate. Just to let you know that 75% of our students have already been through multiple treatments short term. And some of the students that I brought along with me, they actually, all 3 of them have been through multiple treatments. So I'm going to let them share a little bit with you. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. Thanks.
State your name and then go ahead.
Well, my name's Tom. I've been in 11 other treatment programs besides Minnesota Teen Challenge. I've been in 28-day programs, 90-day programs. The thing about the long-term program is this, is that when I first came to it, they stood me up and they showed me what I needed to do and how to change. They put me in situations where I could express and live out what God has given me, sobriety in life. When I first heard about it, there was a person that came from Minnesota Teen Challenge to a jail. But without the... In the 28-day programs, like they stood me up, showed me that what I could do, but then they let me go right away. And I want to make that point really clear, that in Teen Challenge, man, they take you and they walk you through life skills in a way to become a better person, human being, and give back to the community. And that's what all I want to say.
Thank you.
Ma'am?
Yes?
My name's Julie. I'm 25 years old. I've been in this program now for 11 days short of a year. And in this time, I've been through Hazleton and other treatment programs, 28-day programs, and I started using methamphetamines when I was about 16, 17 years old, and they had such a grip on my life that the level of severity of the drug itself, what it had on me, 28-day programs were totally ineffective. I'd go out the same day after leaving Hazleton, and I'd be using meth, and I picked right back up where I started. They were basically just stopping grounds for me to recuperate, get my health back, maybe so I wouldn't die at my next use, and I'd just go right back out there and use. Living in the problem, basically, is what it was. They told me I had a problem, that's it. I've learned in the 12 months that I've been here that, I'm not going to be an addict for the rest of my life. I did have a problem with drugs, and now I'm learning to live without drugs. The faith-based part of the program is key. Just like in any 12-step treatment program they have, you have to have a higher power, and I said my higher power was God. I didn't know who he was. This programming is so strict. It's not an easy program, but it is effective. My brother went through this program, I believe, 3 years ago, and I'd watch him. I was still out using. I'd watch him come home and throughout his stay here. For like the holidays, he was changing. There was a huge drastic change in him. He was actually cooking methamphetamines. It's been just about 4 years. I just went to his wedding a couple weeks ago. He's going to college. He's effective in society. And just by seeing that, I got into some trouble with the law. I sat in jail and had the option to do a year and a day, which would have actually been less time for this program. I got the option to come here, and I wanted to change, and I seen the change in my brother, and I have changed. I'm a completely different person. Going back to how strict the programming is, and they have us working on our character development and changing things about us that aren't us, and I guess what I want to say is 28 days won't cut it, not for methamphetamines or any other drug use. Thank you. Oh, here.
Thank you. My name is Gary Carlson. I'm 46 years old, been through probably a dozen or better secular treatment centers, along with VA hospital treatments. Basically, I'm an alcoholic. When I first stopped drinking, the first treatment center, it was a result of being arrested for DWI, but it was 18 years or so ago, and it took me a week to figure out, how to put toothpaste on a toothbrush. I mean, I was an inebriate. I was so far out of touch with reality. 28 days isn't enough time for you to even get your thoughts in order, and most people are still playing a game at that point. It takes a long time to sit down and take a look at yourself and maybe reflect on the mistakes and the things you've done. And I know I was in treatment for a few months once, and I actually was able to remember some of the sexual and physical abuse that happened to me as a child that I had totally buried. So it was the fact that I had time to just stop my life and take a look at all these things. And I too have the only sobriety I've ever achieved is after going through a faith-based program. And My last wife is still, well, I don't know what happened to her, but she was using meth, and the last time I saw her, she was prostituting herself for the drug, and that situation sent me on another tailspin, although that's not an excuse, but it's just what happened. But I know for people like her and myself, you got to put the brakes on your life. Nothing else matters. You're so far in the addiction. You feel like you're worthless, and you're all talking about the criminal justice system and all the people you have in prison. I've been there long enough and enough times to tell you that most of those guys sitting in there are there as a result of drugs and alcohol. They're not there because they were born a bad person. Something happened to them in their life, as did me, where they feel worthless. And so they start using a drug, and then to support that drug habit or to cover up the fact that they're miserable human beings, they continue to use and they get in trouble. And then they go to jail. And if all you're going to do is put us in jail, all you're doing is putting this person away out of the picture until he gets back out. And then since he doesn't know anything and hasn't changed, he has no other choice but to do what the only thing he knows to do. You know, so I pray that we can help people, because if God has sees fit to help me sober up here, a teen challenge, get my life on track. I was sober 6 years coming out of a faith-based program that was 3 months long. That 3 months made the difference between the 1 month. If I can get sober, I want to work in the prison. I want to go to jail, because these people need help. And you can lock them up, but this is the greatest country in the world, and we're probably second only to communist China in the amount of people we got in prison. You know, it's just sad that we can't do something better. You know, and I know it costs a lot of money, and I've worked and paid taxes, and I just hope that the legislatures and you're responsible for the taxpayers' money. So I hope that when you're looking at programs, you consider the ones that have succeeded, and not just the ones that maybe have a name that everybody knows. You know, it's important that these people that are getting our money and your money that you're delegating actually are producing results for you. I pray that that's what happens here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
Well, I'd ask you to wind up so we can move on to the other two amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would just like to point out, I did hand out a poll, and you know, the public is really saying that they believe in treatment. And it says this one in state, 70% of the people would rather have people have treatment than to send them to prison. And so I think that that even the public understands that that's the best answer to our problem here. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Haymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have a just up here if that's
happened. Fine.
Okay. I'll be brief. First of all, I'd like to say that the A6 amendment, I'm not planning on offering. If anyone chooses to offer that, that's their prerogative. I think that the testimony that you just heard, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is really a good segue into what I'm attempting to accomplish with my amendment. I have long felt that the war on drugs is a failure. It always has been a failure. It's a failure now, and it always will be a failure. Just like prohibition, our war on drugs and locking people up is not going to change drug use in this country. And we need to explore alternatives, not just because this is going to bankrupt the state of Minnesota eventually if we don't get our arms around it, but if you listen to the testimony that Representative Soderstrom's witnesses just provided, I think it's clear evidence that there are alternatives and that we're talking about real lives here. And I think what I think it's clear that Representative Johnson wants to obviously try as best as possible through this bill to alter the devastating effects of methamphetamine. And I applaud many aspects of the bill. What I don't applaud is the ratcheting up of offenses and sentencing in the bill. And specifically what I'm trying to do is in Section 1, I'm basically deleting Section 1 of the bill, And so this would continue current law. And I'm going to ask Jeff Diebel as I go through this amendment to help me out here, because it's been a sort of a confusing process trying to understand all the sentencing for the various levels of the controlled substance abuse crime in statute. So if we delete Section 1, it would continue current law, which would mean that an individual could be prosecuted under the fourth degree sale. Representative Johnson's bill would ramp that up or bump it up to third degree. It also requires an offender to have the intent to sell for manufacturing meth, and that is Section 3 of the bill. And this is what I'm concerned about, members, is that, and I know that this, I may be at odds with the law enforcement community about this, but I just feel like that we've heard enough testimony, we know enough about the research, that you have meth users who are cooking a small amounts of methamphetamine for their own use, giving it to their buddies, whatever. We know the addiction of methamphetamines. And so the question is do you want to incarcerate that individual who's cooking a small amount of it, in the same way you would an individual who is manufacturing huge amounts of methamphetamine and bringing it into the state? And I think even this article, if you read it, I didn't pass it out, but I had read it before, and I think there's enough research that talks about this, that 80% of the meth in Minnesota comes ready-made from large criminal organizations, not from makeshift meth labs. And so, again, are we attempting to stop this problem and putting the net around some individuals who really could benefit more from treatment rather than incarcerating them for long periods of time? So that's what the second part of my amendment does. And then the final part of what the amendment does is in Section 4. It removes... It eliminates the proposed penalty increases that Representative Johnson's bill has for the crime of possession of meth precursors with the intent to manufacture. So, Mr. Diebel, is there anything else you want to say about the amendment? I've been so kind to help me draft this. And
anything to add?
Mr. Chair and members, I think maybe a technical point is that the amendment takes the crime of possession of precursor elements with intent to manufacture and shifts it down to this controlled substance offense in the second degree. And that's currently a first degree offense. And as Representative Johnson has his bill drafted, the penalties for that would be increased. And Representative Paymar's amendment would shift it to second degree and keep the penalties at their current level.
Paper.
Well, I just we're seeing, you know, such a spike in our prison population, and it is due to drug offenses, and we just have to get our hands around this whole problem, and so that's the purpose of the amendment.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would not support this amendment, Representative Paymar. I think it's moving in the wrong direction on the criminal side of things, and the bill that we have put together is very comprehensive, and I think every piece of it is crucial. The treatment provision, which, frankly, if we had more money, would be bigger, and I'm hoping we have more money next year, and I'll be back in front of this committee asking for more treatment money if that's the case. The precursor restrictions, the increased criminal penalties, and the other provisions, they're all... you take any one of them out, and I think the bill becomes much less effective. So the increased criminal penalties actually came from recommendations from the Attorney General's office from a couple of folks who have been working for years on meth issues, and I think they're the right place to go. So I wouldn't support the amendment.
So this, Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymar, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I guess reasonable people can disagree about this, but I really think in light of, you know, the testimony that you just heard, and we all have in our districts drug addicts who've gotten addicted to this horrible drug, and to be incarcerating them for a period of up to 30 years, which statute allows for, and ratcheting up the penalties under your bill is the wrong direction to go. Let's go after the big guys who are bringing the stuff into the state of Minnesota, and let's work with our constituents and their families who are unfortunately, you know, getting caught up in this mess. I think we need a more common sense approach.
Representative Cornish?
I agree with Representative Johnson. We need a multi-pronged approach. The argument I hear from Representative Paymar is the same I hear from the retailers, and let's not try to control just the precursors and lockup and Schedule 5. Most of the material is coming in from out of state or out of country, and that makes about as much sense as this amendment. We throw our hands up and give up on one and attack the big source. I think it has to be multifaceted approach, and I agree with the provisions that are in the bill and don't want to weaken them.
Point, counterpoint, Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask, I think that the spirit of the Soderstrom and Paymar amendments taken sort of as a whole are something that I hope we do take time to really reflect upon. Because there's no question but that a response needs to be made, and I think Representative Johnson makes us, you know, takes us in a good direction for really responding. But I would urge everybody to think about how much time is enough time in prison. At what point, why are we incarcerating people, and why are we doing it for so long, and how much time is enough? I question the idea that more time in prison will alter modified conduct. I think it will for about maybe 2, maybe up to 4 years. Beyond that, I don't think you're changing people. I really doubt that. And I think we ought to take a scientific look at this question. What does science have to tell us as it relates to incarceration modifying conduct? I bet you it would. I know that it would tell us that there is a point of diminishing returns upon which what we're doing is spending a lot of money, but we're not changing people's behavior. In fact, we may be contributing to worse behavior in the longer term. So I do hope that we look at both of these amendments in the light of looking out for the taxpayer's dollar, the idea, which I think is fundamentally a spiritual one, of redemption, and the idea that all human beings are valuable and can be salvaged.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Paymar.
I have one witness, if the committee would indulge us to hear from Dan Knuth from the Drug Policy Reform Group to briefly speak about my amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Dan Knuth. I represent the Drug Policy Reform Group, and I do speak in favor of the Paymar Amendment. Orville Pung, a past Commissioner of Corrections, once stated that we should incarcerate people that we are afraid of and not because we don't like them. County Attorney Backstrom handed out the position paper from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. In their second point, they state the state legislature and policy should recognize the need for severe punishment of repeat or entrepreneurial drug dealers. And this is the spirit of Representative Paymar's amendment, that the individuals who manufacture meth for sale and for distribution should get the highest level of incarceration. Others who manufacture meth for their own use should receive a lesser level of incarceration. My contention is that those who manufacture for their own use probably don't know the law, probably don't understand the law, not only because they're not learned in the law, but they are not capable of understanding the law because of their addiction. I'd like to point out from sentencing guidelines the group of individuals that would be in the first degree, that would be the sellers, of meth that they manufactures. They'd be the first degree drug offenders, third degree murderers, first degree manslaughter, first degree sexual offense, first degree assault, and kidnapping with bodily harm. That would be in the first degree. In the second degree drug offenders, manslaughter, criminal vehicular homicide, first and second degree sex offenders, first degree robbery, burglary with an assault with a weapon, drive-by shooting, first degree arson, and kidnapping with unsafe release of a victim under 16 years. So in other words, the individual who manufactured with the presumption of selling would be in with the first degree that I represented or told you who would be in that first degree category. The other drug manufacturers who manufacture for their own level of use would be in second degree, and they are in a pretty high level of company as well. You all of you understand the concern about proportionality when we deal with offenses and sentencing, and I think the proportionality is, pardon the pun, is out of proportion with the Johnson bill, and I support the Paymar amendment.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one thought to add. I understand the argument that you may want to treat differently people who sell meth, or at least treat those who are manufacturing it for their own use a little less severely, but you need to keep in mind, I mean, we've been hearing for weeks now, if not months now, about the inherent horrible dangers of meth labs. And so the folks who are cooking meth in their homes or out in the field or in their car or whatever for their own use, there's more to it than just that. They're putting anyone else who comes in contact with that, including in many cases little children, at risk of their lives. They're also poisoning the environment at the cost of millions of dollars to the taxpayers. So to me, it's more than just saying they're cooking meth for their own use, because it's a very dangerous and expensive proposition.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond to that. Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, for first degree that we recommend for manufacturing for intent to sale, for sentencing guidelines, that individual would receive 86 months, 7 years, with a range of 81 months to 91 months, which is 7 years out of that individual's life. The second, for this second degree, which would be for individuals who manufactured for their own use, would receive 48 months, with a range of 44 months to 52 months. As Representative Ellison indicated, that how much incarceration, how much is enough, is enough. Do 3 years deter somebody from manufacturing on their own? I'm not sure that does.
We're about ready to conclude. I guess, Mr. Knuth, on that last question, the numbers indicate that in 2003, the cost to Minnesota taxpayer, when you add up corrections, prosecution, public defense, public defender, treatment, environmental cleanup, child welfare, and the whole gamut, that in just 2003, that cost to the taxpayer was $174 million. The numbers, I think, that we've seen on cooking meth versus importation of it run anywhere from 30% up to half, assuming even the lower number of 30%. That's $52 million, $50 to $80 million a year costing the taxpayer because of meth labs cooking it here in this state. I guess my thought is, when we analyze the amendment and what your testimony is, I think it's time that the meth labs were put out of business for good. And we're going to have to weigh your testimony and others when we grapple with these amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I make one considered point on that issue? When we looked at the analysis of who and what positions and where we can reduce costs and all those issues that you discussed, that the court cost would not change. The cleanup costs would not change. The only place that could be the policy could affect costs, and we're all concerned about costs in the legislature now, the only place that we could affect costs would be in the area of incarceration. And as I stated, we would have an 86-month penalty for presumptive penalty for a first-time offender would be in the area of for a first-time first-degree offender was 86 months. The second-degree presumptive sentence is 48 months. We're saving about 3 years, which would be about approximately on the upper side about $90,000 a year, which then would help pay for the other costs. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Knuth, thank you. Also among those numbers, I believe the slides indicated that 40 to 50% of meth lab busts and seizures involved juveniles, children. When a child, an infant, a toddler is taken out of its home because a meth lab is there and they can't even take a teddy bear with them, you know, how do you measure that cost? I frankly want to find a way to put meth labs out of business in this state. There's no further business today.
Okay.